It's wonderful to be here at Chawton talking about Mrs. Penelope Aubyn, because amongst Chawton's holdings are several books by the author, including a rare and possibly unique example of an anonymous plagiarism of Aubyn's 1723 work, The Life of Charlotte Dupont. It was published under a new title, The Inhuman Stepmother, nearly 50 years after the original in 1770. The Inhuman Stepmother, which I think has charming marginalia, the way the person that owns it has written their name on it, makes it look like they're saying it's my inhuman stepmother. And it demonstrates that many years after Mrs. Aubyn's death, her stories were still being enjoyed by readers. Chapbook versions of the slightly renamed Charlotte Dupont were still being printed in 1800. But Aubyn's link with the texts, and indeed almost any knowledge about Aubyn at all, had been lost in the intervening years. In 1777, Elizabeth Griffith incorporated another of Aubyn's texts, The Noble Slaves, into her three-volume anthology of novels. Griffith was very particular. She liked to include biographical headnotes for each of the authors whose novels she included in her anthologies. But for Aubyn, she had to concede defeat in providing the readers with any biographical information. I have what she said. Mrs. Aubyn, the author of the following novel and of many others, is so personally unknown to fame that though I have used much inquiry, no particulars of her private life have come to my knowledge, farther than that she was the wife of a Mr. Aubyn. Yes. My intentions tonight are to introduce Mrs. Aubyn to you and to fill in some of the biographical gaps that Mrs. Griffith could not. I will also explore the lives and adventures of some of Mrs. Aubyn's family, some of them with my holiday snaps, which are listed up here. I should say that I call her Mrs. Aubyn, and even pronunciation is a very contentious thing. I visited the source of the original family name, and they suggested Aubyn. They both, Aubyn and Aubyn, are also used by different arms of the family. And early on in research, I also saw the name written as Altin, A-L-L-T-I-N, and I couldn't tell whether it was a mistranscription or a phonic version of the name, so that the person had heard it as Altin and Aubyn. So for me, Aubyn it is, but I'm aware that it's not what everybody calls her. So, having set out to find more information about Mrs. Aubyn, what actually happens is that the researchers presented with a web of more or less firm and more or less influential interconnections. You don't just find Mrs. Aubyn straight. Suddenly, as I did, you find yourself driving miles to look at a church and its registers for a period somewhere around 100 years before your author was writing anything at all, and standing outside the rectory where her grandfather conducted the post-mortem of his father-in-law on the kitchen table, because he was there when his father-in-law died, and he's a doctor, and because the man was so recently dead, he thought if they opened him up quickly, they would find the gap where the soul had been. But only if he was quick, so the kitchen table it was. Then, however, you do know that you've strayed from your topic. But those connections between Aubyn and her friends and family, I suggest, provide some of the very real tales and experiences that made their way into Aubyn's fictions. Aubyn's novels often present themselves as the memoirs of the lives and strange adventures of heroines and their extended families. And as a biographer, I started very quickly to uncover that she was linked to a family that had some really interesting events and secrets of its own, from the 8 times bigamist uncle, now completely erased from the records of his noble family, and the unmarried mother in possession of a large house on the Thames at Hammersmith, neighbouring Charles II's widow Catherine of Braganza. There were also, probably because of the water, 13 Aubyn living siblings, and many of them took to the seas and reported home on the seizure of their ships by pirates, or they nearly lost their lives at the hands of desperate slaves who were trying to escape en route from Jamaica. And the siblings wrote home to the members of the family who were still at home and plying their trade from London as merchants, silversmiths and watchmakers, and as we'll see, a whole load of other things besides. Whenever I meet anyone else who works on biography, all of those other people, and there are some in the room tonight, I can see them, it strikes me that we have wonderful, really animated conversations about sharing information, squeals of total delight when we find something, and the incredible luck that we're met with sometimes, and convoluted tales of detection where we finally worked out how to find a piece of information, followed by the sheer frustration of stolen parish registers, bomb-damaged archives, and shelf marks that should have something and don't. But as academics, what makes it into print and out into the world when we publish, and often when we present, is the information we've found completely detached from the incidents and accidents of its finding. We also discard some of what's not necessary to the piece of work that we're producing. And I have one here, my very first holiday snap. For example, one of Aubin's dedicatees is a man called Lord Coleraine. And he's a member of the Hare family, and I really heartily recommend a visit here. It's right in the centre of Tottenham. It's called Bruce Castle, and it's the family home of the Hare family, and it's now a local study centre. They also have a fabulous oil portrait of the house as it existed in the 17th century, about the size or bigger as the Chawton one that you have up on the landing, except theirs was found in 2-inch pieces in the attic of the house, and they had to have it reconstructed. And it's enormous, it's absolutely huge. But this is Bruce Castle. When members of the Hare family who lived here died, I can think you can just about see the spire of the church over here. When they died, instead of having a hearse take the body from here and round to the church, oh no, family tradition for the Hare family is that you smash a hole in the ancient boundary wall between Bruce Castle and the church, and you put the wrapped body through it, and it goes to the family mausoleum, and then you brick up the hole in the wall. I know. And then the only piece of unsubstantiated rumour that I would really have liked to be able to prove before I wrote my thesis is that Coleraine's grandmother is reported, unfortunately, to have jumped from this tower with her one-year-old baby. And hers is the only missing death record from the Hare family records. There is nothing, just a complete gap. And you'll guess already that none of that information, none of the interest that we have for the Coleraine family from those anecdotes found its way into anything I've written at all, not even as a footnote. So we find all these fascinating details and then we discard them. And I know that the evidence I find on my subject will be what's most important to other scholars. But I'm also influenced by the academic R.D. Hume on what we can and should do with historical evidence. And Hume asks the academic to go into quite uncomfortable realms, suggesting that to have evidence and then not to use it to analyse and to tell stories and to posit conclusions would be to do only half a job. So I'm going to try and do both parts of the job he suggests this evening by starting with, so who was Penelope Aubin? Aubin was a poet, novelist, translator, playwright and orator, and I would like to add to that list merchant and business advisor. And between 1707 and 1730, Aubin published seven original novels, five translations and a play. And then between April 1729 and February 1730, she also delivered a series of public orations at her own Lady's Oratory in London. She's also the first woman known to have addressed the Freemasons, which she did at their request, and the request of their Grand Master, in 1730. And of course, there may well be missing texts and other evidence still surviving or possibly lost, unfortunately, because the books have a life story of their own. The manuscript of one of the translations, the text that's now called The Doctrine of Morality, was left to Mrs. Aubin in the will of a very young man called Thomas Mannington Gibbs. He left her everything. He died very young, it's a very short will, and he just left her everything, with no explanation why. Have no idea why. And Aubin's final poem, The Welcome, is a poem to the Duke of Marlborough on his return to England during the War of the Spanish Succession. And the poem in its entirety, if you got to see it in its entirety, is more of a reminder that by 1709, Marlborough had stopped winning anything. And in 1956, the academic William H. McBurney quoted three lines of the poem to demonstrate its awfulness, actually. But his notes didn't say which library he saw the text in. And then it just disappeared. And the original owner of the Welcome had obviously been a serial buyer of poems on affairs of state, and they had collected them all together and then bound them into one large volume. It's at the Library of Congress. And in 1864, a very, very careful librarian had gone through the whole bound volume and made a documented note of everything that was in it, and that was on the card catalogue and then in this 19th century catalogue of the Library of Congress. And then when the modern library catalogue was made, the only thing that was on the catalogue is what's at the very front of that bound volume. And so the Welcome was missing. Finding it again was pure fluke. A Google search on Google Books, and someone had digitised the 1864 catalogue of the Library of Congress, and suddenly the Welcome was back with us again. And so those kinds of things, those lost texts, may well appear because of slightly random events. And there have been some glimmers of new interest and work on Aubyn before I touched her in the early 21st century, particularly by Sarah Prescott, who's here in a couple of weeks' time, 3 weeks' time. But in the past, some of the labels that have become attached to Aubyn are a bit off-putting. Mostly that she was a pious, formulaic, repetitive and slightly dull author, and probably also that she was Catholic or Huguenot and the daughter of an anonymous French officer. Actually, even at the British Library, some of her novels are catalogued under France, Customs and Culture. So far, she doesn't seem like she's going to be a topic for a great biography, but I hope we're going to prove her at that wrong. At the start of a project like this, something has to make you want to go ahead with it. And for me, it was that something that I read or the way that I was reading it seemed wrong about Aubyn. And almost none of Aubyn's texts are in print in modern editions. One novel, her first, The Life and Strange Adventures of the Count de Vineville and His Family, was published in 1721, is still printed in a scholarly anthology that some of us use for teaching. And I'm not the first person to notice that the strangest thing about the adventures of Vineville is that he doesn't have any. He travels from France to Constantinople very safely, and then the only adventure he has is that right at the very beginning of the novel he is stabbed to death. It was written by Aubyn with a knowing reference in the preface to Robinson Crusoe, who some of you may know spent 28 fairly uneventful years on a desert island. Count Vineville seems to be a bit of a response. But almost all of Aubyn's texts are available digitally, and several are here at Chawton. Some of them you will have seen out in the library tonight. Thank you to Jackie for setting them up for us. And they're also free to access on a library digitisation site called archive.org, which has some colour reproductions. My journey started with reading The Life and Adventures of the Lady Lucy, and the Lady Lucy is the person who may or may not have jumped from that balustrade. It was dedicated to Lord Coleraine, and I became suspicious about Aubyn's motives. Lady Lucy is a story in which Aubyn gives events really specific dates. And what we find very quickly is the main male character we're following in 1726 is a German with a birth date roughly the same as that of King George I. The very same character is then involved in the murder of a man he thinks has been adulterous with his wife, then the vicious attempted murder of his wife, and then serial philandering. As you would. I wondered if there might be more than simple piety at play in a story that has similarities to part of the Hanoverian King George I's life. Particularly, there's an instance in Lady Lucy which dates to the time of the disappearance and presumed murder of the lover of George I's wife, Sophia Dorothea, had assumed to have a lover called Philip von Königsmark, and he went missing. He thought he might be actually under the floorboards at the house where she was staying at the time. And the dates in Lady Lucy absolutely tie in with that event. So, casting some suspicion on this harmless, pious author. So, from suspicion to action, R.D. Hume's methodology says, if we're going to conduct good research, the first thing we must do is to think about all the information we have and ask, how do we know this? Well, unfortunately, in Aubyn's case, asking how do we know this shows that all biographical roads do really lead back to surviving pieces of contemporary evidence. Actually, two pieces of surviving evidence. Two articles, one from 1734 and the other from 1736, both written by the Abbé Prévost, or the Abbé Prévost, whoever wants to say, in his French language journal, Le Port Écrange, published in London. So it's a French language journal, but published in London, and he was in London at the time. And in 1734, Prévost says that he's commenting on the death and character of Madame Aubyn. And I'll quote him in English because my French is appalling, and also because I think that it gives the true measure of the man. She is a lady born in London, although daughter of a French officer, found it difficult to protect herself from poverty and its miserable consequences. Her wits were her only resource, as although it seemed from her writings that her heart was capable of the most tender passions, she lacked what was needed to make them come to life. She was, therefore, ugly and poor. Two qualities which attract little consideration in this iron century we live in. After she had spent some time trying her powers in diverse little brochures, which she published without putting her name to them, she finally ventured out into the light of day with a novel which she acknowledged as her own work, and which was read with some success, because it came from a woman's pen. But the public's ardour passed with the novelty. Her death, he says, came soon after she delivered some religious orations in London, and actually that's been used to date Aubyn's death ever since, as happening in 1731. Prévost concluded, though, without seeking any other example than Madame Aubyn, what idea should one form of her struggle by only reading her elegant works? What mortification, what torment, to be born so sensitive and so ugly? Charming. Actually, we may never know if Aubyn was ugly. So far, no image of her is known to survive. The only physical relic we have of her, and I'm going to try and find another one of my holiday snaps, is here. It's her signature. And it's this image, and not Aubyn's fictional texts, that was the start of a wholly different biography for Mrs. Aubyn, and a much richer biography. This signature is on a deposition to the Board of Trade in 1709, and it was found completely by accident by a fabulous professor called Joel Bayer, who is an expert on pirates and piracy. It very fortuitously brought two strands of my research together. Mrs. Griffith, our much earlier author in 1777, who had said that she knew nothing about Mrs. Aubyn other than what? That she was the wife of a Mr. Aubyn. It's not as silly as it sounds. Actually, it tells us that before she was a Mrs. Aubyn, she was a Miss something else altogether. And in this document, right at the very top, you may be able to see that Aubyn starts by saying, Penelope Aubyn, wife of Captain Abraham Aubyn, maketh oath. It's my first step. I know who her husband is. And for a biographer on the hunt for records, much of what's left, unfortunately, springs around birth, death and tax. And we'll add marriage, and in the 18th century, taking to law, which seems to be a pastime. And I know then that Penelope Aubyn was the wife of Abraham Aubyn, and that allowed me to do something else, which was to search a thing called the International Genealogical Index, which is now available online in a thing called familysearch.org. And when it finally loads my lovely snapshot, what you'll see here is the very record that I found at the beginning, which is that Abraham Aubyn married someone called Penelope Charlton on the 4th of May 1696. And it's really interesting, not just because it gives us Penelope's maiden name, Charlton, but also because of where the marriage took place. It took place at St. James's, Duke's Place, London. And St. James's is an extra parochial church. It's like another place called Trinity in the Minories, and they were famous at this time in the 18th century for being the site of clandestine marriages. So we already know straight away that this was probably not going to be something that her parents thought was entirely wonderful. Knowing her name meant that I could also then find these. And this is what I mean by taking to law. This document is a legal case, a chancery case, called Aubyn v. Charlton, which took place in June of 1703. It's an argument about money. It's a huge argument about money. I think that scribes were paid by the yard rather than by winning the case, and so it does go on rather a lot. I think that this case took place in 1703 because Mrs. Aubyn had turned 21. That would make Miss Charlton a legal but very young 14 or 15 when she married at St. James's Church in London. And it's the age of quite a lot of the heroines of Aubyn's novels. And this is a court case in which Penelope Aubyn and Abraham, her husband, accused her mother, Anne Charlton, of defrauding her own daughter and withholding her marriage portion. And as I say, it does go on somewhat. But it starts by saying, "Humbly complaining, show unto your lordship, your orator and oratrix, Abraham Aubyn, Jr. of London Merchant, and Penelope his wife, who was a very near relation to Sir Richard Temple in his lifetime, designing to make provision for the maintenance and education of the said Penelope, and was to give her a portion to advance her in marriage, did by deed or in writing, under his hand and seal, or by some other ways and means, give and settle unto and upon your oratrix the sum of £1,000 to be paid to her when she should attain the age of 21 years or be married. The said Sir Richard Temple did deliver to the said Anne Charlton, your oratrix's mother, the said sum of £1,000, so given and settled upon your oratrix and to be paid to her when she should be married or should attain the age of 21 years as aforesaid, which has since come to pass." Penelope's accusing her mother of withholding a £1,000 marriage portion. Anne Charlton, her mother's response, is furious. Absolutely and totally, in no uncertain terms, sets out the fiasco, the whole disaster of the Aubyn's marriage. Anne's response is actually, I think, even more than one page. It's huge. She says everything. "The complainant, Abraham Aubyn, did about the latter end of the year 1695 apply himself to the other complainant, Penelope, his wife, this defendant's daughter, in order to obtain her in marriage. And this said defendant said that Sir Richard Temple, deceased, was so nearly related to the said complainant Penelope as he did think himself obliged to provide for her maintenance and education, and did intend to give her a portion to advance her in marriage in case she had married with his and this defendant's approbation and consent, and had not disobliged him." Believe me, this goes on forever. "Abraham Aubyn's father and mother declared that they couldn't settle any estate or fortune on their son, but that he must get his own living by acting as their factor. And this defendant," she says, "advised him to lay aside all thought of a marriage with the other said complainant, this defendant's daughter, for that the said Sir Richard Temple had positively declared that he would not give the complainant Penelope one farthing in case she married without his and this defendant's consent. But as we know, Penelope and Abraham married anyway. Anne did not give up hope that things might resolve themselves. She says she did provide for them at her own expense for a considerable time in hopes of saving them from utter ruin and that she might prevail with the said Sir Richard Temple to be reconciled. Anne's plans really depended on Abraham's parents agreeing to give him some money. But Abraham's parents absolutely refused. And Anne tells us that Abraham's said mother did severely reprimand him for offering to take away and marry his said wife, and declared she would abandon him, and did immediately in the presence of this defendant. He was forcibly, actually, it sounds, kicked out of his mother's lodgings, and the homeless newlyweds were rescued by Anne, who paid for a cab and took them home to Hammersmith. But 4 months later, the newlyweds were still there. And I don't think that Anne was entirely pleased. And asked Sir Richard to intervene again, which he did. He promised Penelope £50 a year for her lifetime. But for her lifetime only, no lump sum, no money that Abraham or his family could get their hands on. It was very, very specific. But only if Abraham took his wife and started work in Jersey for his father. You can imagine, at this stage in my research, Abraham got the nickname the wastrel in our household. He hasn't really lost it. But in amongst all this detail, I almost overlooked something. What exactly does it mean for Penelope Charlton, daughter of Anne Charlton, who calls herself a spinster, to be so nearly related to Sir Richard Temple? Well, the Aubyns did stick to their side of the bargain and depart for Jersey, but then Sir Richard Temple died, having not made arrangements or a codicil to pay the £50 a year. And though the Aubyns were only in Jersey for a very short amount of time, let's see if we can... You know when you can't see what you want even when you're looking at it? There we go. In fact, on the 22nd of May 1697, the Aubyn's first daughter was born. She's called Marie Anne Arabel. And what we can see from the register is that it's customary in Jersey to continue to refer to a woman by her father's name even after they've married. And in this case, Penelope is listed as Penelope Temple. So, Mrs. Aubyn was the natural daughter of Sir Richard Temple of Stowe and his mistress Anne Charlton. Her father was the third Baronet of Stowe in Buckinghamshire, and although he was a Tory MP and landowner, it's his eldest son, Richard Temple Jr., who we mostly know as Viscount Cobham, who built the wonderful gardens, who is a close friend of Alexander Pope and was in fact a prominent Whig politician when Aubyn was writing her novels, and he was particularly powerful in the sort of the late 1720s and early 1730s. So we're no longer dealing with this daughter of an anonymous half-pay French officer that Prévost would like us to believe. In a court case that Anne brought against Sir Richard's executors, she thought they were being tardy with some payments, Viscount Cobham totally denied that he knew of her name or of her existence or of the obligations between her and his father. And then in 2008, on my way to the American Society for 18th Century Studies, I was really lucky. I stopped off at the Huntingdon in LA. And in typical biographer style, on the edge of disappointment, after 8 days of opening envelopes in a continuous stream of household bills, they were wrapped. So you had to open an envelope, then take out a manila folder, and then take out the bills, and then read the bills, and then put them back. And there were boxes and boxes and boxes of them for the London House of the Temples. 8 days of opening them, and on the final morning, on my way home almost, I found two signed bonds to pay Anne Charlton and her maid at Hammersmith for £50 each, ordered by Viscount Cobham shortly after his father's death. He does protest too much, methinks. But I also found, in that desperate search, that denying or hiding uncomfortable information and uncomfortable family relationships wasn't new for the Temples. The archive contains wonderful letters from Sir Richard's younger brother, John. He was already, as a younger brother, not particularly well provided for from a badly encumbered and debt-ridden estate. And he took to stealing his brother's horses and seems to have moved on from that to bigamy. He contracted 8 bigamous marriages and was not above sending his poor destitute wives back to Sir Richard Temple begging for money when he left them. Finally, when John was arrested, he pleaded with Sir Richard to come and get him out of prison, which Sir Richard wouldn't do. He thoroughly believed he deserved to be there, I think, and spent hours describing these terrible, awful conditions in prison. The best that Sir Richard would do after intervention from their mother was to use his title to have John's sentence commuted from death to 7 years of transportation. But John's name is now completely absent from Temple genealogies from that point onwards, so trying to track him down is quite difficult. And I thought that we might just pause here to make a diversion back into the fragments of Anne Charlton's heritage, and therefore Aubyn's Charlton heritage. So Anne Charlton was Penelope's mother and Sir Richard's mistress. Anne is another fascinating woman, and her relationship with Sir Richard was not one that played out the way that my preconceptions made me think they might. Sir Richard was clearly actively involved in the life of his daughter, of his natural daughter. He paid for Penelope's maintenance and education, and he fully intended to give her a marriage portion that, when I saw his will, the marriage portion is the same size as that he intended to leave his legitimate daughters. He made no difference between them. Penelope had been born in around 1681, if we count backwards, and when Sir Richard died 16 years later, Anne and he were still exchanging secret notes from his deathbed, using his physician, a man called Dr. Wagstaff, to get notes in and out on his deathbed under the nose of the family. So this was a long-term relationship. Anne was also a really financially savvy woman. She took Sir Richard's executors to court when they were late with payouts from his estate that she thought were due to her, that she knew were due to her. And what remains, unfortunately, of Anne Charlton and Sir Richard's Temple relationship are pretty much, at the moment, only those financial records. For example, the bonds. And there are also Anne's scribbles on the back of some of Sir Richard's estate deeds that she held. Between them, they seem to have developed a form of 18th century money lending, laundering, really. Sir Richard would give her money, which she would pretend was hers. She would mortgage it back to him, and he would arrange to pay her back on the mortgage and then repay her the sum. And while the mortgage was in place, she held the deeds to one of the most expensive parts of Sir Richard Temple's land, a part of the estate called Thornborough, which was pretty much the only part of the estate that made any money at that time. And when you turn those enormous deeds over and look at the back of them, what you see on the back are notes from Anne saying, "Got from Richard, £100. Got from Dick, £200. And they're these enormous manorial documents. Anne's tax records show that she lived alone in a nice house in a very fashionable part of Hammersmith on the Thames, and we'll have a quick look at where she lives, in the Upper Mall in Hammersmith. And this is, the Thames is kind of literally facing the Thames. It has its own steps. And in 1686, the Queen Dowager, Catherine of Braganza, selected the Upper Mall in Hammersmith for her residence. She immediately commissioned building works, and actually, in May and June in 1687, 11 men worked on newly enclosed gardens, planting jasmines, honeysuckle and myrtle and stocks. And you'll note when you read some of Aubyn's novels that her fictional spaces, all female spaces, like harems, often have enclosed scented gardens. Catherine was a devout Catholic, and she's thought to have established a convent in Hammersmith, but but she did not. There is a convent in Hammersmith, and it does border the grounds of Catherine of Braganza's house, but it was set up much earlier in 1669 by a woman called Frances Bedingfield. The buildings are still there in Hammersmith. They're the school, the Sacred Heart School. And the convent educated the daughters of the Catholic gentry. But Catherine of Braganza's Catholic courtiers also lived nearby in this run. There was Lady Fingal and her daughter Emily Plunkett, and they're the relatives of St. Oliver Plunkett. So these are a very high-profile Catholic family. Oliver Plunkett, who was martyred at Tyburn in 1681. The Earl of Bedford had a property nearby intended for his daughter, Lady Allington, and her brother was William Lord Russell, who'd been executed for his part in the Rye House plot in 1683. So it's this community of genteel Catholics that Aubyn was growing up around in her childhood, and I think may hold the key to the fact that she is thought to have been a Catholic author, because her portrayals of Catholics in her novels are very sympathetic, particularly after the Jacobite uprising in 1715. That's quite unusual. And it may well be because all of the Catholics she met in her childhood are here living in Hammersmith in these very nice houses, very genteel. But thinking about her mother living here in Hammersmith, Aubyn doesn't just have unusually good Catholics in her novels. Her portrayals of female characters in her novels are also not straightforward. There is not this opposite, this polar opposition of virtuous girls and bad girls. In Count Vineville, which we talked about earlier, there are two women, the impossibly virtuous Ardalisa and the unfortunate fallen Violetta. But both end the novel with good characters, good marriages, and as friends moving in the same social circle. If we stop with Anne, all my records of Anne after the court cases end in 1703. There are no more surviving records that I can find. But I do know something of Anne's parentage, which seems to have had a direct impact on Penelope Aubyn's life. Anne's father was Walter Charlton, and Walter Charlton was born in February 1620, and he died in 1707. Aubyn seems to have allied herself to her grandfather's Charlton heritage. Her first poem was The Stuarts, and it charts the royal descent of Aubyn's beloved Queen Anne at the same time as it charts Aubyn's descent from a good royalist stock. Walter Charlton lived to be 87, which is good news because he was the royal physician to Charles I, Charles II and James II, so it gives a bit of credibility to his role as a doctor. His father died when he was less than a year old, and very little is known of him until he went to Magdalen Hall in Oxford in 1635. He was granted MD by the King at Oxford 8 years later. But before he was granted MD, Walter Charlton had unusually already married and had at least two Charlton children. They were baptised in Ludgershall, and it was in Ludgershall that Charlton was visiting to see his wife when he was present during the death of his father-in-law, and so carried out that post-mortem on the kitchen table. The visit also meant that Mary, Anne's elder sister, and the Charltons' first daughter was born 9 months later. Walter Charlton was a founder member of the Royal Society and a president of the College of Physicians. He published at least 26 books, medical treatises and fiction. I recommend his work, The Ephesian Matron, to everyone. Many of his works have aristocratic dedicatees. John Dryden and Robert Howard wrote commendatory verses. But Charlton also championed the education of women. He presented a harangue to the president of the Royal Society to persuade the society to allow his friend, a woman, Margaret Cavendish, whose works are also out in the library tonight, to observe the experiments of the Royal Society as the first woman to be able to do so. Charlton was an Anglican, a royalist, and in the 1690s he also resided on Jersey. And it was during his time in Jersey that Walter Charlton wrote a most personal letter about his state of mind to a man called Sir John Lowther. Voluntary solitude, interposed by intervals between the tides of secular affairs, is not only grateful but profitable also, yea necessary to a man who studies rightly to know both himself and this fallacious world. Time and experience hath long since taught me. But it may well be doubted whether involuntary or compulsive, such as close confinement now compels me to suffer, be either easy or amicable to the soul of even Seneca's wise man. The pages after this letter, this very personal letter in Charlton's journal, have been removed. looks like they've been razored out. 5 pages with a very sharp, straight edge at the back of the journal near the spine. But even this glimpse that Charlton would hold this conversation with Sir John Lowther is intriguing for its implications, because Sir Richard Temple also knew Sir John Lowther. He knew him well enough to leave a secret bequest separate from his will, which was intended to get ready money out of Sir Richard's estate to his mistress, Anne Charlton. Walter Charlton's other possible link is that he returned from Jersey to London in 1695. When his granddaughter decided to make her very permanent attachment to the Jersey man Abraham Aubyn, which puts us very neatly back with Penelope Aubyn marrying in to a family of trade. And I'm going to put the Board of Trade picture just back up again. In 1696, when Penelope Charlton, or Temple, married Abraham Aubyn with his brother Henry as their witness, she married into a family of merchants trading from London and Jersey and with family members on Barbados, Constantinople and Lisbon. Our evidence, unfortunately, is more court cases that we're not going to look at tonight. But in 1701, Abraham sued a wine merchant called Garrick, David Garrick, the actor and manager's grandfather, because Garrick had had Abraham arrested for non-payment of a debt. The debt had actually already been paid, but to be released from arrest, Abraham had handed over 47 dozen of men's fine stockings. Garrick had then sold them at below the market price, and Abraham sued him for the money. And the original debt related to an eighth part of a share in a ship called the Fidelity in a trading voyage back from Virginia. So what we now know is that Aubyn could get his hands on some fine stockings, and I also know that the extended Aubyn family of siblings and cousins had fingers in every pie. If it could be bought and sold, then they seem to have been involved in it. Cheese, silver, watches, stockings, sugar, wool, lace, pretty much everything that you could need in 18th century London. We also know that sea voyages, like the Fidelities, where there are ships, there are pirates. And the Aubyns must have become quite adept at evaluating that risk, because when trade directories of London started very shortly after Aubyn's death, the family business address in Lothbury was listed as Aubyn and Debray Marine Insurers. So, not unexpectedly, during what is nicknamed the Golden Age of Piracy, that Joel Bayer and Adrian Tinnis would have both written wonderful things about recently, pirates feature very, very prominently in the first four of Aubyn's original novels, Count Vineville, Madame de Beaumont, Life and Amorous Adventures of Lucinda, and the ever-popular Charlotte Dupont. But Penelope Aubyn's experiences of pirates started much earlier, as we know, and were not fictional. In 1701, Aubyn became aware of a scheme, a project, being pitched by two men, Peter Dearlove and John Braholt. They suggested undertaking a salvaging scheme to dive to the wreck of the Bon Jesus. There is a single surviving copy of the prospectus for the broadside prospectus of the salvage operation. Honestly, it's rarer than hen's teeth. And it's currently up for sale, but the bookseller really kindly gave me the information from the prospectus. And it says that the ship was loaded at Portobello with 4 million pieces of eight, 20 tons of silver pigs, £120,000 sterling in bars, coined gold, and 300 tons of wood. Personally, I'm not surprised it sank, but soon after it left the harbour, it was chased by a privateer and wrecked on a rock. The return on investment the prospectus proposed was £3,000 for every £50 invested. This was a very rich wreck, if it ever existed. At some point in the Bon Jesus scheme, Penelope Aubyn was consulted by potential investors, who were the sons of some of Walter Charlton's closest friends. She was not impressed with the characters of Braholt and Dearlove, and she was right. The scheme collapsed amid rumours that it was a fraud and that the men intended to take the laden project ships and head for the notorious pirate bolthole of Madagascar. And here we are, back in Madagascar. This is what the Board of Trade is considering in these documents. Undeterred, Braholt and Dearlove proposed a new scheme to repatriate the pirates of Madagascar. And this was the scheme being discussed by the Board of Trade in these documents. It was about pirates and money. The British pirates wanted to come home from Madagascar. As I understand it, their life was becoming quite uncomfortable. The natives didn't really want them there anymore. If they tried to leave, they would be arrested and then executed. And the Spanish were becoming more and more dominant on Madagascar, which meant you had an enclave of British pirates with nothing to spend their money on, and they wanted to come home. The pirates say they're rich. Over £20 million rich in 18th century money, not even attempting to do a worth calculation in today's money, and that they would hand over a big chunk of their fortune if they could come back to England. The Board of Trade were considering this request, and they were considering it in two ways. If they do this, should it be a private venture that makes profit, or should they send the Navy to get them? Or should they do nothing at all? Daniel Defoe publicly supported the repatriation project in the Review. He estimated at the time that the national debt was about £9 million and that the pirates would repay £6 million of it if they were allowed back. But it was Penelope Aubyn and not Daniel Defoe who was approached by the private projectors, and she would get a share of the profits if she would help them raise a petition from the wives and relatives of the pirates asking for them to be pardoned. Particularly, they thought that Aubyn would be able to get the wife of the notorious pirate, Captain Avery, to help them. But Breholt and Dearlove were involved, and given her poor opinion of them, Aubyn declined and told other investors to do the same. Then she gave this deposition to the Board of Trade. Dearlove and Breholt were themselves pirates. They were in Newgate Prison in 1703 on charges of piracy. But Breholt saw his background as a good thing. Who can negotiate with pirates? Another pirate. But for Aubyn, the problem was that what you're being asked to do is give safe passage, loaded ships, money, goods to known pirates to go and rescue other known pirates in the hope that they're going to come back. Aubyn's had some other quite serious concerns, and her main ones were that she did not believe that Queen Anne would pardon the pirates, or that we should accept back such immoral men. And then, more importantly, as a businesswoman, she didn't believe they had the money they said they had. She was right. The scheme never happened. But these experiences of pirates and her knowledge of trade and shipping informed her novels. And one piece of surviving evidence, I would suggest, informs them more than the others. And it's this. Of the Aubyn siblings, Abraham's brother David is the one for whom most records survive. David lived on Barbados. He was a plantation owner, a merchant, and a ship's captain in the Navy. And you have got to feel slightly sorry for David at certain points in time. He was a ship's captain of the Deal Castle, and he took a ship, a Spanish ship, in retaliation for the wrecking of the Walbull, or the taking of the Walbull, a British ship. And he was court-martialed for it. Because unfortunately, out at sea, no one had managed to get a message to him to tell him that the war had ended with the Spanish. And so he had proceeded on his old orders. He was forgiven. But in 1720, he wrote home to his brothers Abraham and Henry in London. And what he says is this: I cannot but acquaint you with my last misfortune, being at anchor with my brigantine Prosperous, which is not very aptly named, in company with three French sloops. Anyway, what happens is that another ship comes up, and all of a sudden she tacked and bore down on me. Then she fires on them unexpectedly. And he says, I returned all the great guns I could, but before we could load them again, the sloop boarded us with her bowsprit over our stern and entered upwards of 50 of their men, which obliged us to retire under the quarterdeck, having only 8 men left with me, for 2 of my men stole away in the French boat at the beginning of the engagement. There we defended ourselves for near 2 hours. but my quarterdeck being at last cut to pieces in many places, and the grenades and powder flashes being thrown down among us, my people cried for quarters, and the steerage doors being opened, the enemy came in and furiously with their lances and cutlasses, and fell a cutting me and my people in a most barbarous manner, and I should have had no quarters if one of the privateer's men, which did know me, had not rescued me from the hands of those villains. We were all stripped and beaten most unmercifully, and besides two musket balls which I received in the middle of the action through my right thigh, I was cut in three places in my head after we had surrendered. I had one man killed and most of my men wounded with cutlasses. We killed 13 of rather the pirates' men and wounded about 18 or 20 more, of which several since are dead. This attack appears actually almost word for word in Charlotte Dupont, and I was in a quandary about whether to show you it here tonight, but it's in the library, so I think that I probably have stirred off enough for you to want to go and read it yourself. I'd like to end our journey by showing that nothing from birth to death was right in Prevost's biographical summary of Aubin, though we still don't know if she was ugly. And perhaps someone here tonight will find the portrait or the image that we need to put us all out of the misery of suspense. I have one final anecdote. This is really my holiday snaps, because this is my husband and my goddaughter pointing at St. George the Martyr Church in London. This is the church where Aubin was buried. It's probably better known to other people as the church in Little Dorrit. Aubin died at the end of April 1738 at the home of her friend Dr. Smithson. So she was alive and in London when Prevost twice wrote that she was ugly and dead. And here, on May the 5th, 1738, Abraham Aubin placed an obituary for his wife in the Daily Post. You'll love it. It's just here. And it says, "On Sunday se'nnight was interred at St. George's Church, Southwark, the remains of Mrs. Penelope Aubin, the wife of Captain Abraham Aubin, who served with her late Majesty Queen Anne in all her wars with Spain and Portugal. A gentleman of great experience, a good officer, a good officer and engineer, to whom she had been married upwards of 42 years." It's wonderful. He goes on to say, "She was daughter of the Honourable Sir Richard Temple Bart of Stowe in the county of Berkshire, Knight of the Noble Order of the Bath by Mrs. Anne Charlton, second daughter of Dr. Charlton, sometime president to the Royal College of Physicians. Well, if only he could have told me 2 years earlier, my journey would have been considerably shorter. But I think we've gathered that Abraham tells us more about himself than he does of Aubin. So I hope that the journey we've had tonight certainly presents the web of fascinating family members that we can bring to life that maybe he didn't. To end as a biographer on a very personal anecdote, because biography and doing biography and being involved in a subject like Mrs. Aubin is a very personal thing, and they have a way of getting under your skin. The day after I found Mrs. Aubin's burial records for the Register of St. George the Martyr, I was out for dinner with a group of six people who started our PhDs together. So we all started together in Winchester on completely different cross-faculty PhDs, everything from medieval monasticism to creative writing. And one of our lovely creative writers, a lady called Mel, was telling the group that her normally level-headed flat-coat retriever called Morse had recently refused point-blank to walk over a grave in a graveyard nearby in the New Forest. And she was really surprised. Then our lovely philosopher of the group, Rebecca, recounted that her father is an Anglican vicar, and at the church he had been based at until recently, the family's two dogs had been really freaked out by a particular grave in the graveyard of the church. They wouldn't walk near it, they barked at it, and they spooked Rebecca and her brother every time. The church that Rebecca was talking about was St. George the Martyr in London. And so you can see that biography suddenly becomes a very personal journey.